I have some testimony that we will receive. I have three people, and only three people that we will receive testimony from on House Bill 3400 today, so we will reopen or open a public hearing on House Bill 3400 for the purpose of receiving their testimony, and invite up, let's take the first two, I guess, Russ, Don Darrow, and Mary Brooks. Welcome back, and welcome.
Thank you. I'm just going to turn the dais over to Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, to our guest, Mary Brooks.
Thank you very much, and I want to apologize. I thought I had this all worked out with a 4 o'clock flight, but I best laid plans, I guess, never quite work out. My name is Mary Brooks, and I'm director of the Housing Trust Fund Project for the Center for Community Change. The center is a national nonprofit organization based in Washington, D.C. that provides technical assistance to community-based organizations on housing and community development issues. As the director of the Housing Trust Fund Project, I provide information and technical assistance to those working on housing trust funds all over the country. The Housing Trust Fund Project is the only comprehensive national clearinghouse of information on housing trust funds, and the only source of technical assistance in creating and implementing those funds. I want to thank you for inviting me to comment on HB 3400, and want to share with you just some experience of housing trust funds around the country. Trust funds have clearly become widely recognized as one of the most successful and intelligent ways to address critical housing needs, because a balanced housing supply is so essential to the health of communities. We have really come to understand that if we don't commit resources to providing housing for those that are not served by the private market, that we cannot sustain healthy communities and viable economies without making a commitment to affordable housing. And housing trust funds are quite simply a way to do this. It is nothing more than to provide resources necessary to sustain communities. Housing and homes are the foundation that communities are built upon, and housing trust funds enable us to address that critical issue. There's not a lot that we can control in communities, but housing is one that we can, and housing trust funds are a way to create safe, nurturing environment for future generations. There are now more than 170 housing trust funds around the country in cities, counties, and states. They have committed hundreds of millions of dollars to provide homes for low-income people. They have created thousands upon thousands of units, and they tend to leverage their dollars at least tenfold by other public and private dollars that are brought into the community by virtue of the Housing Trust Fund existing. They are, in fact, so popular at this point that we anticipate consideration of a national Housing Trust Fund this legislative session. The most rapidly growing area of housing trust funds, believe it or not, are regional housing trust funds. And, of course, it's nothing new to recognize that housing is a regional issue. Of course it is. It crosses jurisdictional boundaries in any number of different ways. But regional housing trust funds are, in fact, a relatively new idea. Indianapolis, Indiana, which is also a metropolitan government, just passed a housing trust fund, and they're working now to establish that. Columbus, Ohio, and its surrounding Franklin County have joined together to create a trust fund. Sacramento City and County, California, have created a regional linkage program as a basis of a housing trust fund. The Washington Area Housing Partnership in Washington, D.C. is working to create a regional housing trust fund. And Bellevue, along with six other communities in King County, Washington, created a regional housing trust fund, and it has been operating successfully since 1993. I have to say that HB 3400 is one of the most intelligent approaches to creating a regional housing trust fund that I've seen. And I say this for several reasons. First of all, it sets up what I think is a reasonable governing body to administer the fund, which I think is essential to the success of a housing trust fund. It utilizes the urban growth boundary as a sensible area within which to operate a regional affordable housing district. It actually identifies what I consider to be the best potential revenue source for a trust fund. It also allocates resources to those needs that are most important to the region. And these are consistent with characteristics that I would attribute to successful housing trust funds around the country. Several years ago in Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania legislature passed Act 137, which enabled counties throughout the state to double their document recording fee if they put those funds into local affordable housing funds. It is not unlike the strategy that HB 3400 would enable within the Portland metropolitan area, utilizing, of course, a different revenue source. But what it did, what Act 137 did, is enable counties to access and the option of accessing a revenue source and put that into affordable housing. It is so popular that more than half the counties in this state have opted to double their document recording fees and put that money into affordable housing, and it's now generating more than $20 million a year to support needed housing. At least 38 states impose real estate transfer taxes, and in some states, transfer taxes can be generated locally as well. Perhaps the most famous with regard to housing trust funds is Florida's, which commits its documentary stamp tax to a housing trust fund and generates $180 million a year to support needed housing. In my written testimony, there's a chart on page 4 indicating transfer taxes that have been committed to housing trust funds and the rates of those transfer taxes, so you can use that for comparison. The transfer tax is an appropriate revenue source for a trust fund, and I know this is what's most controversial here. The revenue source is always controversial in a housing trust fund. If we'd been able to identify a revenue source that wasn't controversial, I'd be famous, for one, but we haven't been able to do that yet. And so we keep struggling to identify one that does work. The transfer tax is generated through the value added to residential development and transfer. It does not impose an unfair burden on any particular industry or individual. It is not regressive. And it has the potential for generating significant revenues. For all of those reasons, it's an important opportunity to have an impact on housing. There's no evidence that a reasonable real estate transfer tax would have any negative impact on the housing market or unduly influence development. When South Carolina passed their housing trust fund, they used a real estate transfer tax in 1992. They got enough opposition about the transfer tax that they actually called other states that had increased a transfer tax and put that into a trust fund to find out exactly what kind of impact it did have. They were unable to identify any negative impact, and that trust fund passed in South Carolina. But more important, I think, is the opportunity to create a regional affordable housing fund in Portland would generate enough benefit that whatever the real or imagined negative impact would clearly be offset. First, it would set aside homeownership opportunities and increase the ability of families to purchase their own homes. This not only gives business to realtors, it gives business to home builders and many other industries that are associated with turning housing into homes. This has been well documented in other housing trust funds. It also enhances opportunities for local industries to attract employees because there is actually a housing supply that they can take advantage of. Secondly, it would provide funds to create a more balanced housing supply. This has been well documented, the relationship between housing and improved education, reduced health costs, and many other benefits that are associated with housing. Finally, and probably most importantly, is it gives us an opportunity to take a step forward, which we are not doing in providing a balanced housing supply these days. We're getting farther and farther behind. It may be difficult to do today, but it's going to be far, far more difficult to do it tomorrow. And at some point, we need to take the step and move forward and say we need to commit resources to providing affordable housing. I think if HB 3400 is passed, you'll actually be on the forefront of creating the possibility for a regional housing trust fund. All this does is give the Portland metropolitan area an option to do something, to move forward, to reach out and have a solution to address its own housing issues. And I think it gives the area an opportunity to join dozens of other cities that have realized that creating an affordable housing trust fund is an important step to take in addressing housing needs. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Brooks. Other questions? Representative Corey.
I just have more of a comment. I would say thank you very much for coming today and offering us this perspective, more of a national perspective. I think that we've all heard a lot of scare stories about how negatively this would impact the Portland metropolitan region if it was enacted, and I appreciate the national perspective that it hasn't generated the type of negative impact nationally that has been suggested.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Beck.
I think part of what we're struggling with here, this session, is just it's raw interest group politics. There's one group of people that want it who are trying to support, solve a problem, affordable housing problem. We've decided this is the solution or something like this. We've scaled back the proposal to really do almost nothing.
Mm-hmm.
but still, the interest group politics are fierce. There's another group that doesn't want it. Camel's nose under the tent or whatever they'll say. Or how have other states worked through this fierce, these fierce competing interests? And I guess where they've passed this type of mechanism recently, how have the competing interest groups either come together or just agree to disagree? And secondly, where these real estate transfer taxes have been imposed, are the interest groups that generally oppose them, are they constantly trying to undo them and revise them, or is there a pattern that once they're in, they really aren't that big a deal, and people go away, lick their wounds, and mm-hmm. and life goes on?
Well, the best example probably is Florida, where the Association of Realtors joined in supporting the trust fund there, and they have continued to support it. That group has stayed together. It's not just realtors, it's home builders, it's environmentalists, it's housing advocates, and they have formed a statewide coalition that created that trust fund in the first place. And they recognized that they actually had something to benefit from that. Realtors do have, along with bankers and the housing industry altogether, have something to benefit from the increased production of housing and the preservation of existing housing. And in this bill in particular, you've already set aside a portion of it to home ownership, which would directly benefit realtors. And of course I deal with this a lot, any revenue source that's identified for a trust fund is opposed by somebody. If we were going to go after, let's say, an increase in the hotel-motel tax, then the tourism industry would be here.
sort of a sore subject right now. Okay.
I just want to tell you, it could be worse. And but I think it's important to see what is factually correct. I mean, we're talking about 0.75% here, which is less than a realtor fee on the sale of a home. And part of closing costs, it does not add significantly to the price of a home. I mean, you can just do the numbers and see that it does not. The bill also has exemptions for people who would be low income and in other situations. So it's really designed in quite carefully. And it seems to me that the negative impact of it is, if it exists at all, is reduced substantially. In Illinois, which they also use a transfer tax for their trust fund, I have been told, although I don't know that this is true, that realtors have said that they are actually happy the trust fund exists because they know the trust fund is there to take care of certain kinds of households that they can't typically work with, and they actually refer people to the trust fund. So there definitely are partnerships that exist around the country. My understanding is that it's not that realtors are against providing low-income housing. I don't think they are. But they certainly don't want the transfer tax to be opened up as a revenue source for any number of issues. I mean, if it looks good for housing, well, then what keeps it from looking good for education or something far more gigantic? And so I think that's part of the concern, not so much that it would have a negative benefit or a negative impact in the Portland metropolitan area, but just what it means in terms of the future. And so we just have to be sensible. I mean, anybody can tell you have to be sensible about tacking on any kind of tax or fee to an industry, and it can be done in a reasonable way, and it can be done in an unreasonable way, but there's nothing in this bill that is unreasonable, in my opinion.
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Beck?
Forward a little further, since we have a out of...
She's an expert.
Well, we have perspective from somebody outside of the Capitol here, from outside the state, so it was helpful. I don't know whether you have thoughts on general tax policy, but we are all learning some of that this session, and we try to look at taxes that have a broad base, that are that can have low rates, but have a broad base of support or tax a broad base. How do you look at a real estate transfer tax? Is it something that's very narrow and affecting one group of people, or is it truly the sort of tax that has a broad base tax from?
It's broad in the sense that it for something that is housing related, but it clearly is not as broad as the sales tax or an income tax, I mean, definitely. But if you look at in terms of kind of tax policy, the transfer tax is not regressive, which I think is important, where a sales tax is typically considered regressive. So if you look at some of the broader taxes that might be options, there would be negative things associated with those. So in this sense, I think there probably isn't a housing-related tax or a fee that is any broader than the transfer tax, but it clearly is not as broad as some other taxes. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, no, I was always looking for perspective, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. And
Representative Kapori and I had an interesting meeting with a senator about this issue recently. The comment was made that the perspective that the senator had, and it was very genuine, but it was that this was a taxing Italians, sort of a very narrow tax on a group of people, by, I think, the perception that this was taxing realtors, which I don't perceive it that way. I really see it as a fairly broad-based tax that anybody who rents is going to pay something through their rent, anybody who owns property is going to pay it at some point when they transfer their property. So it seems to me I don't understand this argument that this is a very narrow-based tax on a small group of people or a small interest group. That it is something that really everybody pays one way or another.
No, indeed they do, and you can, I mean, all you need to do is look at what the rate of home ownership is in the Portland area or the transfer of residential units, and just see how often that happens to see how broad a tax it is. And you're right, I mean, it impacts virtually everybody in that sense.
Thank you.
Thank you again for coming all the way out to appear before us today. Appreciate that.
It's my privilege. Thank you.
You bet. Rich Rogers, then we'll wrap this up and get on to the safe study. Gary Conkling, are you coming up with Mr. Rogers?
Can you find
him?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Gary Conkling, representing Oregon Home, which is the coalition group that sought the introduction of House Bill 3400, and I appreciate the opportunity to just say a word or two today. For those of you who know me in my other hat on a bill that you just had on the floor today, perhaps it's ironic that you will look at this issue and in a moment what Mr. Rogers will present to you on the map over to the right about the realities of what it takes to put important infrastructure into communities. In this case that we're discussing, affordable housing. It doesn't happen automatically. It requires investments of a variety of types, either investment in land or an investment in resources to make affordable housing actually exist. We ask Metro to develop a map, which, again, Rich will explain what it is in just a moment, in response to a suggestion by those who are less enamored with this bill than we are, of an alternative solution to how to deal with affordable housing. And we thought that graphically it would be useful for you to see what it might look like to look at a development pattern to put in place housing to meet some of this need, if in fact this would actually accomplish the objective at that. And with that, Mr. Chairman, if I may, let Rich explain the map, which you can see to your right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rich Rogers. I'm a staff assistant to Portland City Commissioner Eric Sten. I've worked for a number of years, both in, at Metro and at the city, on growth management issues and housing finance. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today. The map that you see, and I apologize to the audience for not having something more visible, demonstrates what would have happened had the region not made an attempt to fight sprawl, had they allowed the historical development patterns to continue unchecked. And you see, represented in the map is an expansion of the urban growth boundary of approximately 100,000 acres, which is more than 10 times even the most radical proposal that was actually on the table at Metro. The biggest proposal that was on the table was an expansion of 10,000 acres, and that was eventually defeated. So this is more than 10 times that amount. Now, I want to talk for a minute about the financial implications of such an expansion. It's been suggested that were we to allow growth to go unchecked, that somehow that would take care of our affordable housing problem. I want to be very clear that there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever that the first time home buyer market nor the housing needs of the very low income residents of the region would be met in any way at all by allowing for such an expansion. What I do think is if you parse out some of the arguments that have been made in opposition to the bill and with alternative suggestions by expanding the urban growth boundary somehow going to take care of our problem, I think what you'll find is that the urban growth boundary might be putting some pressure on houses that are in the $250,000 to $350,000 range, but the urban growth boundary is not the barrier to homes that are affordable to first-time home buyers, and it is certainly not a barrier to providing housing for people who are elderly, who are disabled, and who are in other very low-income categories. The market cannot support very low-income residents. We need investments from the public sector to take care of those needs. And so I want to highlight, and I don't think you'll find a credible person who studied this issue for a long time who will say that the market will take care of very low-income residents. So I want to highlight that to the committee and emphasize that the region has worked on this proposal for 3 years. There is no viable alternative, and we really need your support to be able to take care of our problems in the local area. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Rogers? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3400, and let's get to our informational meeting on the SAFE report. I'll turn it over to you for that.
Okay. Before I get started, Mr. Chair, I want to remind everybody that Monday the meeting is at 9 a.m. in room 50 for the revenue forecast. So it'll be joint with the Senate Revenue Committee and with the Joint Ways and Means Committee.
And there'll be no afternoon meeting, right?
Yeah.
On Monday.
What time?
It's 9 o'clock, and it's room 50. We'll have a spot set for everybody.
Oh, well, that's that, all right.
Biggest room we've got. And it'll start at 9 o'clock, and I would guess run till 10:15 or so.
And no afternoon.
No afternoon. We may be sunny died by then. Okay.
My wife, a lottery going on this, and for $5 you get to buy 1% down, 2% up, 1% up, 2% up, 3% up, and all proceeds go to not my campaign.
The general fund. Well, if it's 1% down, do you pay $5? If it's 1% up, do you get $5?
$5 either way.
Oh, darn.
And I know the answer, so I'm getting all the money.
Well, I do hate to interrupt this.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to remind everybody once again, this study, which you received last week, delivered to you on time. There's also a summary packet that the contractors have provided, Technical Associates and William Mercer Incorporated, won the contract that was issued and managed by the Secretary of State Audits Division. And just wanted to read to you very briefly what the RFP stated was what we were looking for, what the state was looking for. The Oregon legislature seeks an unbiased study assessing the current and future degree of competition in the state's workers' compensation insurance market. And the study must address the following question: are there sufficient economic incentives for a firm to enter and or remain in Oregon's workers' compensation market? And this question should be addressed both in terms of current market conditions and under plausible alternative scenarios for the coming decade. I think the consultants will talk about those trends and what they might mean for the industry. I do want to emphasize that the RFP did not request policy recommendations. It was intentionally narrow to make the study doable. That would give you some information to make decisions in the future, but in no means was it prescriptive to give you some a policy statement as to how to regulate the workers' comp insurance. So,
all right. We have, want to come on forward, both of you, I guess. Mr. Elio and Mr. Lefkowitz. And I will turn it over to you to walk us through your overview of the report.
Hi.
Thank you, and welcome to our humble revenue committee.
Indeed, a beautiful day in a beautiful state.
Thank you.
I believe you've been distributed the handout that we've prepared, which is a series of excerpts and tables and graphs from the report in a blown-up fashion to make them easier to read. And we'll proceed with that in just a minute. I will handle some of those and discuss them, and Mr. Lefkowitz will do some of the others. And let me try to give you a thumbnail of what the bottom line, so to speak, is. As we saw, the ultimate objective of the study was to look into the future, really, and to ascertain the extent to which the market would provide adequate financial incentives to keep private insurers in the marketplace. The future looks not nearly as good as the past, not only in a general economic sense, but particularly for the insurance industry, and especially workers' compensation insurance. The reason for that is that there's a lot of upward pressure on medical costs. The extraordinary capital gains vis-a-vis the stock market of the past 5 years are pretty much gone now. And capital costs generally, as a result of the dampening pressure in the stock market, has made capital far more expensive for business generally. In that environment, looking to the future, the central thing that we find that might jeopardize the ability of the workers' comp market in Oregon to sustain competition is, say, stability to pay large policyholder dividends. If, for example, SAFE is able to sustain policyholder dividend rates of 20% to 30% to 40%, and private insurers attempt to match those kinds of payments in terms of the prices that they would ultimately charge to employers, their rates of profitability would be driven to dangerously low levels. For many, we think they will have little choice but to leave the marketplace or to write only the preferred risk. That will mean several things. One, there will be an increase in business concentration in the state. The state presently has what we call a duopolistic characteristic, that is, almost every market subline of business that one looks at, SAFE and Liberty Northwest are ranked 1 and 2 in the marketplace. We don't think that Liberty would leave the marketplace or change its underwriting practices. Accordingly, business concentration will rise because after Liberty, there is virtually no one in third position, even close to second position. So the likelihood is that, as I said again, they will withdraw from the marketplace or write the more preferred risk. SAFE's job, as we understand it from a statutory standpoint, is to pay policyholder dividends to the extent it can. to make workers' comp insurance affordable, as widely available as possible. So the payment of policy dividends is fully consistent with that mandate. SAFE has done this in the past, and has done, as we best we can detect, a reasonably good job at fulfilling the interests of small business. In fact, the major area of business concentration that SAFE holds is in the very small premium sizes. That is, premiums in the neighborhood of zero, $1,000, $500, or perhaps as much as $5,000. So with that perspective, let me turn briefly to the series of handouts and summarize what these handouts demonstrate. And I'll do a few of these and then turn it over to Mr. Lefkowitz. We found in the study that the income tax exemption for SAFE has not been a big deal. It has afforded SAFE some competitive advantage, but in the big scheme of things, it has not been that significant. In fact, the underwriting losses that SAFE has generated over the past 5 years were so large that SAFE effectively would have never paid income taxes anyway, even if it had been subject to income tax provision. In part, that was true because SAFE paid very large policyholder dividends. Looking to the future, to the extent that there is an upward pressure on medical costs and payment of benefits accordingly rises, large underwriting losses are likely to be generated in the future as well. And to the extent SAFE pays relatively large policyholder dividends, perhaps not at the levels that they were able to pay in the latter half of the 1990s, they will also generate relatively large underwriting losses, which will swamp investment income gains because those large capital gains will no longer be present. And hence, looking to the future, they would not likely pay any income tax, even if they were subject, or if their tax-exempt status were removed. So we generally find that while there is some benefit associated with being tax-exempt, it is not a significant benefit, and it certainly does not place private insurers at any material competitive disadvantage. That's essentially.
Last question.
Yes, go ahead.
I'm not an actuary, and so we're trying to struggle with some of the information we're getting here. And if I ask questions that seem elementary to you, I'm going to ask you to just to kind of go along with you.
Sure.
A bit. We've had the SAFE's had huge capital gains in the last in the 90s, as many people have had. Don't they have to pay tax on those on the capital gains?
No, the tax exempt.
But if they had to pay tax on it, would that have been a significant factor?
The underwriting losses were significantly greater than the large capital gains, and hence the net effect would be they wouldn't have paid any income tax anyway.
So your analysis of the income tax exemption incorporates the capital
gains. That's correct. The other thing to keep in mind is that underwriting is subject to 35% rate, where investment activity generally carries an effective rate of about 25%. So if everything else were equal, if you had underwriting loss of $100 and investment income of $100, if you had an underwriting loss of $100 and investment gain of $100, you would actually have a negative income tax liability.
Oh, Christian. The question also comes forward that if they had big underwriting losses, then their premiums haven't been enough to cover those losses. The losses either were from poor risks being accepted or not a premium being charged. The net result was that the company was quotation marks running in the red other than their investments, but that was never reflected in their premiums, I would understand. Is that correct?
Are we getting ahead of your report?
We are indeed, but
okay.
I will say to you that you are absolutely correct. You cannot sustain a policyholder dividend rate of 20 to 30 to 40% out of current premium dollars.
Thank you.
Okay. Here we go.
These gentlemen have a 3 o'clock date in the Senate committee, so I do want to be sensitive to the time to get through their reports. Representative Kefouri?
Not knowing much about workers' comp, are there, is SAFE underwriting losses comparable to other, like to Liberty, to other insurance companies, or do they have more than others?
I'll let Ms. Walker.
Well, and again, are you going to get to that in the report, too?
Or? We'll be there shortly.
Okay. I'll hold my question.
Go ahead.
Clarification, Mr. Chairman. Is the income low because dividends were paid? And if the dividends were lower, would there be more income?
There would be, but the underwriting losses still would be substantial. And under normal market conditions, what I mean by that, in the absence of these rather significant capital gains, it's still likely to be true for most workers' compensation insurers that underwriting losses swamp investment income, and hence they effectively don't pay income taxes on current business.
Okay, but in this case, if they pay zero dividends, would they have then made profit?
Comparatively little. It would not be significant.
Representative Carlson.
Okay, this question is just going back to what you said earlier. You talked about, and in the report, I actually read parts of it last night, the duopolistic situation that we have here in Oregon. You talked about SAFE and Liberty Northwest, but there's also self-insureds. And I'm wondering, was the scope of your question only to look at the comparison between Liberty Northwest and SAFE, or was it also to look at that third area in terms of comparing how the Oregon workers' compensation system works?
We looked at both self-insurance as well as employer groups, mm-hmm. for example, an alternative to the other forms. The level of self-insurance in Oregon is comparable to what it exists elsewhere. And so if self-insurance information were available across for all the states on an equivalent basis, which it is not, it's only available on a very limited basis. The relative degree of concentration in Oregon, taking into account self-insurance everywhere, would still be comparatively higher than exists in most places. The other interesting twist on the duopoly is most of the employer groups are effectively insured by also SAFE and Liberty. Yeah. So the duopolistic nature of the marketplace not only exists in what quote-unquote the voluntary market, but it exists within quote-unquote the employer group market as well.
Thank you. Please proceed.
That essentially deals with what has been labeled as A and B. B is essentially a typical, we call it hypothetical, a typical workers' compensation insurer, and it effectively says if you took a typical workers' compensation insurer and you made them fully tax exempt, their prices would fall by roughly 2%. So if they were charging something like $5 per $100 worth of payroll, and you made them tax exempt, they charge $4.90 for $100 worth of payroll. And that's the effect, roughly, of what income taxes are for a workers' compensation insurer. So an income tax is not a big deal for these guys because, quote unquote, they deal with what is termed a long-tailed product. Unlike a short-tail automobile insurance, et cetera, then income taxes has a substantial impact. Handout C is what I'll call the crux of the public policy issue, and that's a comparison of policyholder dividends paid out by SAFE as compared to other state funds. And to summarize, over the past 95 to 99, SAFE paid an average rate of about 50%. The average of all state funds was about 10%, and on a weighted average basis, the average was about 12.9%. So it puts that in perspective that the level of policyholder dividends paid out by SAFE has been extraordinarily high. Only Idaho has come anywhere close, and they did that in a couple of years. The typical payout with state funds is in the range of 10%. And we believe that going forward, the market could sustain a payout, a policy dividend payout rate of 10% in the future. But we don't think the market could sustain on a competitive basis a payout rate of 25% or higher.
Well, that was my question. I'm not sure if I understood the last sentence. I was going to ask you, looking proactively, if the capital gain situation is no longer possible because the market is so much worse, did you project where SAFE could be in terms of its level of dividends? It can't possibly sustain the level of dividends you see here in 1998, 1999 in the future. Is that correct?
It can't sustain them out of current premium.
Could it sustain them out of the reserves? Is that
yes.
For how long did you plan?
I will allow Mr. Lefkowitz to address. These get pretty actuarial questions, and let me ask Scott to talk about that a little bit.
Are we ready to move on to the reserving issue?
Yeah.
All right. First, I want to caveat everything I'm going to say in that we did not do a reserve study on SAFE. That was not part of our assignment. That would be a massive undertaking. Rather, what I've done is I've really poured through two basic sets of data available from SAFE's published annual statement and data reported by SAFE to the National Council on Compensation Insurance for the purpose of rate making. The data reported to the National Council is it's handy data to have because it has a very long history, going back individually by policy period over 20 years. So you really get a good picture of what's occurring. At any rate, let me present to you some observations that we've made regarding the level of reserves maintained by SAFE. Graph D is an illustration of the ratio of loss reserves to paid losses on a pure calendar year basis. What this is the year ending, using calendar year 1999 as an example, it would be the reserves existing as of December 31st, 1999, divided by losses paid during calendar year 1999. We have in this graph three entities, SAFE, the Oregon Workers' Compensation Insurance Market excluding SAFE, and the Workers' Compensation Insurance Market countrywide. And you can see that the level of reserves relative to paid losses for SAFE is more than twice the insurance industry in your state as well as the insurance industry countrywide. Graph E is a similar illustration. Again, it's the year-ending reserves divided by premium written during a calendar year. And again, it's done for SAFE, the Oregon market excluding SAFE, and countrywide. And you see the same phenomena for the latest five calendar years. Graph F is a similar graph, but it's done on a policy year basis. Graph F is the best way to describe it is an appropriate matching of losses to claims. The prior graphs were calendar year numbers, which is the results of many policy years or accident years combined. Graph F actually segregates the reserves and the payments due to a specific set of claims by year. And that's a more appropriate actuarial approach because you're matching losses to the claims that generated them. We did the same type of measurement, loss reserves to paid losses, and we see that SAFE, again, it has more than double the reserve level than the rest of the industry in the state of Oregon. Graph G is the same measurement, but instead we did it on what we call an accident year basis. The difference between an accident year and a policy year is an accident year captures all claims with accident dates during the particular calendar year. A policy year captures all claims with accident dates on policies written during a particular calendar year. And they're two slightly different measures. But the point is that you're matching losses to the claims that generated them. And again, you see you see the same phenomena where SAFE has materially greater, more than twice the level of reserves than the rest of the industry in Oregon. We did the same measurement again on a policy year basis, loss reserves to written premium, SAFE in Oregon. Again, you see the same thing. Graph I is the same thing on an accident year. Again, matching losses to claims, you see the same phenomena.
If I could ask this last series of slides, going back to D, I suppose. In a nutshell, just going through them there, they seem to. I guess I see what they say. What do they tell us?
What they're telling you is that no matter how you parse the data up and no matter how you examine it, SAFE is carrying roughly twice the reserve level as the rest of the insurance industry in the state of Oregon. Now, whether that's appropriate or not is a different question. As an actuary, I think it would be appropriate to find out why. Now, does SAFE have a materially different set of claims that are generating these losses? Based on what Dr. Elio has examined, they tend to write the same types of classes as the rest of the industry. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the differences reside generally in the size of the risk, rather not in the types of business that they write. I mean, this is something that I think this is a question that should be answered.
It's my understanding, I'll get to Representative Williams, but that the Department of Consumer and Business Affairs last year required SAFE to add $52 million based on some actuarial review. And how that plays into this? Or
I could not answer that.
Okay. Representative Williams?
Well, and this gets, I guess, to a question that I've had for a long time, and as I was looking at the executive summary that you prepared, which I confess is the only document that I've actually looked at, as opposed to the two thicker ones, which I haven't quite got through the appendices on.
Not a bad thing.
Yeah. But it is this sentence there where you're talking about the reserves, and you say that the discretion is further reflected in the unusual reserving practices of SAFE relative to other OWCI insurers. And I guess my question is, can you define for me what do you mean by unusual reserving practices?
Well, at the very least, I would say that they are, as these graphs indicate, they appear to be carrying, based on these metrics, twice the level of reserves as the rest of the industry in this state. That in itself is unusual. Now, the question is, which is appropriate? Is SAFE's reserve level the appropriate level, and is the rest of the industry under-reserved? Or is the rest of the industry appropriate, and is SAFE grossly over-reserved? Now, the answer is more than likely someplace in the middle. The question is, to which end is it closer?
If I could follow, Mr. Chairman, aren't the reserves that the private carriers carrying mandated at least to some certain level by national insurance regulatory requirements?
The reserves, the answer is yes and no. The reserves that an individual insurer carries is mandated generally by the state of domicile. If the state of domicile through their triennial or whatever financial examinations that they conduct find that the reserves that are carried are not within an appropriate range, they will act. And they will tell the insurer to raise those reserves.
Right.
Within your state, this is speculation on my part, but I would assume that through your own regulatory process, you examine the insurers that do business in your state and make the same types of judgments. I'm not aware of I'm not aware of any studies that have been done on SAFE specifically.
Well, the difficult challenge, Mr. Chairman, is with most of the questions in this discussion, it always seems like the answer is both yes and no.
No.
I'm not faulting you for that, but I guess I was just struck by the phrase unusual reserving practices.
Well, let me expand on that just a little. I will address a bit on the delve a little bit into the technical side, and hopefully it won't be too demanding. We examined various ratios in the data provided by the National Council, and there's a good example of what I would call an unusual, what I view as unusual or different. If you look at the level of what we call IBNR, or incurred but not reported reserves, in very old policy years that are on the order of 20 years old, carried by SAFE, we found that those years, they assume that more than 25% of the total medical costs that they expect to pay for claims incurred 20 years ago are unreported as of today. That means that they can't be associated with any specific case. Again, bear with me. Let me describe to you two types of reserves. You have a case reserve, and then you have an incurred but not reported reserve.
Mm-hmm.
A case reserve is something that's established by a claims professional. He looks at the case file. He says, okay, this man is going to have a back surgery. He's probably going to need physical therapy for the rest of his life, et cetera, et cetera. Based on his experience in dealing with these types of claims, he sets a reserve. The other type of reserve, the incurred but not reported reserve, is set by an actuary. Because the actuary knows from examining past experience that the case reserve more than likely is always too low. Because there's always going to be new information that arises in the future that causes reported costs to increase on claims that remain open for an extended period of time.
Right.
This is the nature of the loss reporting process. You would expect for claims that were generated by accidents more than 20 years ago that the incurred but not reported components of the reserve would be relatively small. Because after all, most claims have been reported. You pretty much know where the claims that you have are going to go. Why would you expect that 25% of your reserves on those claims would have to be actuarially determined as an incurred but not reported component? To me, that's unusual.
Mm-hmm. What would be the appropriate percentage based on your experience?
It's going to vary by state. Again, we're getting into the yes and no question again, and I'm sorry, but that's the nature of the business. It's going to vary by state. It's going to vary by the type of business an insurance company writes. I have not seen that magnitude in my experience for a year that old.
Can I quickly follow with just one more?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you haven't seen anything where that reserve has been as high.
That's correct.
What's the highest you've ever seen before this one?
In all honesty, I would say I can't relate. I would speculate 5%.
Okay.
Total losses.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome, Representative Carlson.
I have a couple questions too. One, I wanted to follow up on Representative Williams' discussion about the. I had also heard that there was some sort of a limit or of an area in the private market where reserves were not supposed to go over. I mean, that was something that I had heard. And so then my other question would be, if you look at Liberty Northwest, for example, or a private market, during the same period SAFE was earning interest on their investments, wouldn't also the private market have been earning interest on their investments, but yet rather than paying it back in dividends to the people who paid in, the employers, it would go to... In a private market, you have shareholders, right? So isn't it a different system? Aren't you sort of comparing apples and oranges a little bit by comparing a quasi-governmental body that doesn't have shareholders with a private market where the structure is set up differently. Can you comment on that? Did your analysis
well,
take that into consideration?
I'm going to defer 99% of that to Mike. I just want to make one comment with respect to the level of reserves. Regardless of whether you are examining the reserves of a quasi-governmental agency or a private insurer, there's a set of actuarial techniques, quite varied set of actuarial techniques, that you could use to determine what the appropriate reserve level will be. And that's going to apply to any entity to which you transfer risk. It doesn't matter whether it's an insurance company, a large self-insured corporation. The process is the same. And that's my answer with respect to reserving. Everything else goes to Mike here.
Well, let me let him finish answering that question, and we'll pick that up.
Only if you created, say, by statute, a distinction between a government corporation and a private corporation, would there be a difference? That is, capital, irrespective of how it's employed, whether in a public enterprise or a private enterprise, should be entitled to earn the same earnings, rates of return. The question now is, what do you do with those earnings once you get them? Now, Liberty, for example, has to upstream those things to the parent. It's got to pay corporate overhead, and some money's got to go to stockholder dividend. You don't have that situation with SAFE. There's no mandate, but SAFE does have an obligation to fulfill its statutory mission, which said it should be making workers' compensation insurance widely available on an affordable basis. It meets that in part by paying out policyholder dividends.
Can I ask one more question, Mr. Chair? I understand also that there was a dividend payment during the time that you looked at that was the result of litigation that happened in the 80s, about $80 million. Was that factored into your analysis as well, as did you consider it all as sort of together?
Together. We did not try to segregate out the source of the funds. The only thing we looked at it on a performance basis, how did SAFE behave with the funds it had available at that time?
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And going back to the amount in the reserves that are required for either SAFE or for an independent insurance company, if you take into consideration the rising cost of medical costs, wouldn't it be better to be over-reserved than under-reserved?
No. Not even yes
or
no?
There's a no. I can see yes or no, but I know.
So you've addressed a real issue with respect to the regulatory process and reserves. I mean, essentially what you're referring to is a SAFE position,
right?
A contingency fund. To the best of my knowledge, I have not come across a state. And I've done work for a number of states. I've not come across a state that permits a contingency fund. Now, when an actuary does his calculation, does his thing, per se, generally what we do is we come up with what we call a range of reasonable estimates. This gets back to the yes or no. Because if we gave you a point estimate, I can guarantee you that it's going to be wrong. There's going to be a 50% probability that any estimate we give you is too low, and a 50% probability that it's going to be too high. But what we can give you, through our knowledge of the business of insurance, our knowledge of statistics, and our knowledge of actuarial science, is a range of reasonable estimates. We say, this is a low range, this is a high range. Anything above the high range is probably over-reserved and should be investigated. Anything below the low range is probably under-reserved and should be investigated. An insurance company should have a reserve estimate that falls within an actuarially determined range of reasonable estimates. There should not be a safety cushion in the reserves. The reserve should reflect what the insurance company actually expects it's going to pay out for claims for which it is responsible.
Representative Bates, I think you were next.
Well, I'd preface this question by saying I think it was Harry Truman that said, give me a one-handed economist, so he can't say on the other hand. Okay? But having said that, intuitively, it seems to me, and I want to know if you agree with this or not, that if you have an agency such as SAFE that is has such large reserves that it can afford, at least in a short-term time, 5 or 10 years, to pay back, basically pay back the premium it's receiving, even though it's taking huge losses during that time, and then is jeopardizing the competitive market in the state, that we have a problem with too high reserves. Understanding also that SAFE has not taken on the burden of saying we will insure everybody in the state, we're the only insurer, that we are in a competitive market, and we're going to be one of the competitors in that market. It would seem to me intuitively the reserves are way out of line for what they should be doing as far as a competitive market is concerned, because they're going to drive other people out of the market ultimately. I mean, who in the right mind as a company would want to be competing with another company that has its workers' compensation completely paid for by reserves and insurance company while they're paying premiums out themselves? You're not competitive anymore.
We think that's a concern.
Yeah. On the one hand or the other hand?
No, that's a concern. The only thing I would want to caveat what I've said, and I've already said it, but I want to repeat it because it's important, in that I have not performed a detailed actuarial analysis of SAFE's reserve level. And I don't want to represent to you that I have. That is something that I believe should be done. In conjunction with such an analysis, I think that SAFE's reserving methodologies, the methodologies that have produced the numbers that generated the charts that I've showed you, should be examined. They should be retrospectively examined, meaning if they were off, why were they off? What assumptions caused them to produce numbers that were perhaps too high?
That's something I'd be interested in knowing too, because again, I think it was the actuarial review in the last year or so that led DCBS to require the addition to the reserves.
I have not reviewed any such study. That's all I can tell you.
Representative Whitten, then back to Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two questions. First, gentlemen, do you believe that SAFE's current reserve levels create an impediment to a competitive market, in that they use these reserves, if indeed they have excessive reserves, they use them to pay dividends that net out premiums at a point that becomes difficult, if not impossible, for private competitors to enter the market successfully?
I will respond to that by saying that possibility definitely exists. The extent to which it actually occurs is obviously another question, but that possibility, and I would call that a threat to the ability of the marketplace to sustain private businesses, that is, would reasonable financial incentives be afforded to private enterprise?
All right. If I can follow up, Mr.
Mm-hmm, you sure can.
Do you believe that the fact that we appear to have a duopolistic system in Oregon, and do you believe the fact that the net premiums that many employers or policyholders seem to be paying to SAFE seems to be excessively, extremely low, is evidence that SAFE's reserves are being used in such a way to impede a truly competitive market?
I don't think there's any evidence, at least historically, that the rates are too low or too high. All the characteristics suggest that the market's worked pretty well in the last 5 years. Rates have been reasonable. Profits have been decent. No private insurer has been hurting. So given the market circumstances that existed historically, SAFE could pay out high levels of policyholder dividends and still not restrict the ability of private insurers to earn reasonable profits. Conditions were conducive in the past to be able to do both.
In Oregon?
In Oregon. I don't think the future is going to hold that prospect. There's going to be a trade-off between those two items. That is, there's nothing wrong with, say, fulfilling its mandate, making workers' comp affordable and widespread. On the other hand, if it exercises that to an extraordinary limit, chances are going to drive private insurers out of business, and concentration will increase more precipitously here in Oregon because of the duopolistic nature of the market.
Representative Brown.
Back to the reserves again. If I understand right, what you said was to really truly evaluate whether the reserves were the right amount, whether they were too high or too low, you need to have further study as to what they were reserving to cover and the potential for loss that was within them?
Yes, that is correct. There should be an independent actuarial study of what SAFE's reserves should be. And that would include an examination of the methodologies that they have used in the past to produce the numbers that they post in their annual statements.
Well, I tell you, we're almost out of time, but believing that the Senate probably starts with the same degree of punctuality that we do, I'd like to give you 5 or 10 minutes to try to wrap up, I guess. Okay. Some points that we may have missed through our interrupting and peppering you with these incisive and insightful questions. Well, I wanted to say that for the record.
Let me just go through the rest of the handout very quickly. I think we've covered most of the points. And I'll pick up with N, which is a comparison of what is termed the four-firm concentration ratios measured on an insurer group basis. And let me also note here that insurance groups in Oregon are no different than what exists across the country as a whole. One of the largest insured groups hold anywhere from 10 to 20 subsidiaries that write business in almost every state in the union. And Oregon is very characteristic of that pattern as well. So there's no structural difference about Oregon vis-a-vis other states. But concentration is higher, principally because of SAFE, and secondarily because Limity has an extraordinarily large second-place share of the market in Oregon. And that's true with respect to the what we call CR4, CR8, and Exhibit O, and the Herfindahl-Hirschman Index, which is quite high here in Oregon. But again, I don't want to repeat what I said earlier. Despite concentration, rates have been pretty low, the profits have been pretty good, so the market has worked pretty well. So concentration per se is not necessarily a bad thing. I would like now to turn your attention to what is marked as Q, because I think this is a kind of interesting exhibit. And it emphasizes what I term the duopolistic nature of the market. It also demonstrates that SAFE's doing a pretty good job at what it's supposed to do. It is serve small business interest needs. And you'll see generally as the premium size declines, SAFE's market share falls and Liberty's market share rises. And during the period 1994 to 1998, when some specialty writers made inroads into the Oregon market, such as Gross's Insurance Company, and it diminished the market shares of SAFE and Liberty, Liberty felt the brunt of the decrease in market share. SAFE was able to withstand it quite a bit better. Moving to what is R, that shows that the profitability in Oregon and others compared with other states has been comparable. S shows a similar situation for 6 selected insurers that we examined in considerable detail for purposes of the study. And T shows a comparison of the 18 lowest cost workers' compensation states in the United States, ranging from Virginia down to Oregon, And the characteristics shown in this table display rate decreases ranging from anywhere to 20-50% over the last 5 years. Similar business concentration ratios, except in the monopoly states, where the state fund effectively has a lock on the market. But the rates of return have been comparable across all these states. So the message of this exhibit is the type of market or model that a particular state might utilize doesn't seem to affect the outcome in the market, but rather what's governing, either from a statutory or a regulatory standpoint, how the market is performing. Because if you look at the bottom 18, so to speak, you find just the converse. You'll find examples where the highest rates of return are in monopoly states, and also they have comparatively high rates, and then you'll also find instances in non-state fund states that have high rates and low rates of return, all sorts of anomalies like that. So the market model doesn't seem to be the issue, but rather how that market model is governed. Exhibit U shows the historical rates of return on equity earned by the 21 largest major property and casualty insurance companies in the United States, and a forecast of earnings going in the future by value line. It portrays the very sharp downturn in profitability that's occurred toward the end of the 1900s, and forecast showing that profitability remained below the higher levels in 1996 and 97. And to just finish looking at D and W, something I pointed out previously, financial analysis that we conducted where we modeled through what is termed internal rate of return modeling, the actual financial characteristics of six insurance companies that operate here in Oregon. The analysis shows that in the final exhibit, which is marked as W, if these five private insurers were to price on a competitive parity basis, that is, were to attempt to meet the prices of SAFE, with SAFE paying dividend rates, policyholder dividend rates of 25-40%, the rates of profitability would fall below the cost of capital to these private businesses. That is, whereas it would be costing Liberty 9%, 10% to raise capital, it would only earn 4% on that capital. The only instance in W where the market, we think, could sustain a comparatively high rate of policyholder dividend is the 10% case, because profitability would still remain, in, for the private insurers, in the range of 8 to 11%, which is not a significant reduction. So the market, we think, could sustain policyholder dividend payments by SAFE and SAFE in that range, but beyond that range, financial incentives in the marketplace would begin to dry up. And that concludes our remarks.
Okay. Unfortunately, that'll have to conclude our meeting. I know that you're in, you're required in Senate. One thing I might suggest, I know that this report has probably generated as many questions as answers, and maybe more than that. And I know that we have stakeholders here in the room today. I would expect that probably representatives of Liberty and SAFE and any other interest parties are doing their own analysis of this report, and I think at some point my inclination would be to sit a day to receive responses, I think, from those interest groups on the report as well, so we can get a complete response. Yes, Representative Beck.
We ought to invite the former chair of the committee to join us next time we do this. Since he got this all started last interim, we ought to make sure Representative Strobeck is at least in the audience.
He's here.
Oh, is he? Oh, I didn't see no other. I couldn't see him.
All right, I want to thank you very much for your excellent work and for being with us today. Enjoy your time in the Senate. That'll sleep your crowd, so you might not have as many questions from them. But thank you very much. With that, committee, we are adjourned.